Tape 24, side 1. House Labor Committee, June 1st. Say that again.
The committee will come to order. The clerk will note those present. All others are excused. As most of you know, there's an agenda tonight for Senate Bill 1048 and 1050. Through an error in my office, that Mr. Zeller, who signed up to speak previously on other workman's comp bills, thought that the hearing was on 1050 was tonight. Was this morning. And he appeared and drove all the way in, and he cannot be here this evening. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up the hearing on 1050 to have Mr. Zeller given the opportunity to come up and give his testimony, and then I will have that put into the record for tonight's hearing. Mr. Zeller.
I'm Nelson Zeller of Albany. I'm here in representing myself and general public. I came down due to an error in a phone call that was made to me, and I'm sorry to say that it has to happen this way, but that's the way it is. I spoke before in regards to cutting the costs and cutting of the workman's comp coverage in regards to the fact that if you cut your accidents down, I think you would come a heck of a lot farther. But also there's another little instance that bears a great deal of scrutiny, and that is the fact that we have private insurers in the field of the workman's compensation, and there's nothing that says that they cannot take any account that they want as long as it's a profitable account. And when it becomes a costly item to them, that they can cancel the people out. And this is one of the big things that has been bothering me throughout the years. Management in the past fought for the three-way comp bill, and they got it. Now they can't live with it. And who is to suffer other than the workman, as far as I can see? But cutting out the third step, or the circuit court step in the procedure, making it going to the appeals, court of appeals. And that is basically all I have to offer in regards to the 1050, other than I do not feel that it is in any way a help to the injured workman. Now, could I speak on 1048, or do you have something?
You go right ahead.
Well, in regards to 1048, as I can see and foresee, that a permanent injured workman will not have any incentive, or it will cut the incentive. Maybe I should say it that way. It'll cut the incentive for him to become a individual who may become self-sustaining, or at least more than living on just the disability. And if you've ever had to do it, Mr., it's a hell of a small amount of money to try to live on. I did for 5 months one time, and it's pretty meager. But when you take the incentive away from a man, if he's going to work and try to develop something out of what abilities he has, and then cut him back when he becomes up in the class of money, I would say that you practically cut his all idea of him trying to better himself.
Mr. Zeller, part of the bill that I think you're most concerned with is that Section 6, that at 65, it had a gradual phase out of the...
Yes, this is the one that I am.
So that bill had an initial hearing last week, and I think it's fair to say that all the parties, both labor and industry, have agreed that particular section will come out of the bill. I think that labor especially was concerned about the situation that you're talking about, and I think that what happened, that when everyone reviewed it, they found out that there was probably little, if any, cost saving to anyone to have that provision. And I believe that that particular section of the bill will be deleted, Section 6.
Well, I certainly hope so, because as far as I can see, it's doing nothing except causing the fellow to sit back on his haunches and say, no, if I make anything, they're going to cut my throat, so why should I attempt to?
Even the employers recognize the problems with that section.
I hope so.
I hope that will be coming out.
Good.
So the bill, basically, the offset that will be in the law will be the permanent total and the Social Security disability offset, just those two.
Well, when you get down to the brass tacks in that manner, I would say this too, in regards to the offset from the Social Security. You might class the disability that a man incurs throughout his lifetime and becomes a permanent disabled man or injured, and you might say that that is a fee that's paid out of his lifetime and to a fund or insurance policy. And then when, as I like to relate it, is the buying of an insurance policy, and then when you become 65, you start whittling it off, because it goes to the Social Security, and it places the Social Security and the federal government in the, as I see it, in the manner of picking up the tab for the workman's comp. I may be wrong, but this is the way I look at it.
Mr. Stiller, I want you to know that you and I philosophically on that issue agree completely. I think that you're...
There's something wrong with both of us, then.
I know. I don't think that I'm going to be able to change what's going to happen, but I happen to agree personally with you on that issue.
Any other questions anybody wish? My views?
Thank you very much, Mr. Stiller. 1050 in both these bills will be set for another hearing after tonight. And
good.
This time, I'll make sure that the staff gets the correct time for you. But I will make sure that your comments now are being put on the record for tonight's hearing.
Well, I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, because I did get up a little early.
I apologize to you for that. That was our fault.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks for the rest of you for indulging.
Thank you, sir. The hearing on 1050 and 1048 is closed. That the bills will be heard this evening. I'll open the hearing at this particular time to House to Senate Bill 301. The reason I'm going to hold up on 423, if I could, is Senator Tia wants to testify.
Yeah, I'm waiting to go call
them. Oh, they called earlier this
morning. Oh, they did?
He doesn't want to?
He doesn't want to.
Okay. Mr. Roy Green?
We're on 301.
Yes, we're going to be on 301.
My name is Roy Green, and I'm here jointly representing Employee Benefits, Inc. and AOI. We are proponents of Senate Bill 301, and perhaps so that you understand exactly what this bill does, I'd like to give you an example of what is now happening. Let's consider that this is a restaurant, and I, as the owner of the restaurant, decide to paint it. And I hire a painting contractor who brings in three or four painters, and they're up on ladders painting the roof or the ceiling, and one of them knocks a can of paint to the floor. And because he's in a hurry, and he's got another can of paint right there, he just keeps on painting. And the paint gets all over the floor, and one of my employees comes along and slips in that paint and hurts herself. She then has the right under the third party provisions of the law to sue the painting contractor whose employee was the proximal cause of her slipping, that is, the paint on the floor. And so she sues under the third party benefits of the law and recovers something, and part of that recovery she's able to keep, and part of it goes to offset the costs of the claim. However, the painting contractor suddenly looks at his whole card and says, "Now, wait a minute, under the Oregon Safe Employment Act, you, as the owner of this building, are required to maintain good housekeeping. And admittedly, my employee did not come down and off the ladder and clean up the paint, but neither did your employees clean the paint up. And therefore, you are at least contributorily negligent." And so the painting contractor comes back and then sues me as the employer of this injured worker. Now, I have already provided workman's compensation coverage for this worker. And supposedly that is the sole and exclusive remedy as far as I am concerned. However, on this so-called action over, then I not only am paying for the workman's compensation, but I'm also paying for at least part of the cost of this third-party recovery that was made. So I have actually not an exclusive remedy, but only partially exclusive remedy. This was for many years a part, or the exclusive remedy was for many years a part of the law, but we've had two or three court cases in which this has been violated, and the amendments to 018 are in here to eliminate that violation of the exclusive remedy.
What was the house bill?
Carl Frederick Associated Oregon Industries. The house bill was 2202, which was introduced at the request of the Oregon State Bar. You people passed that out of committee here.
If I could explain to the committee the problem we had. 2202,
yes.
Let's see. It's in the back of the book, I guess.
It had a subsequent referral to judiciary.
It'll be in your folders.
Okay, it's in the folders. What happened is we had 2202 in the committee at the very beginning of the session. That was a bill that was introduced, as Carl said, by the Bar Association. That bill and this bill, except for, if you look at Senate Bill 301, the B and C, lines 14 through 19, are not in 2202. And what happened is that the bar came in and they said that they thought it was a good idea. The bill 2202 had a subsequent referral to judiciary. That at the same time, there was an identical bill dropped in the Senate. But after we sent 2202 to the Judiciary Committee, a number of the larger employers in the state became aware of the bill and became concerned about the so-called indemnity agreements.
Only the utilities, I might
say,
and the railroads.
And which just seems to be a practice in their industry that they have. And they thought that the way the bill was originally written, 2202, that in fact it would change, and it would be a change to the detriment if they did not get subsections B and C, which appear in 301, into the law. Chairman Myers of the Judiciary Committee and I talked about it, And we decided that since I had the Senate bill, and it had already come from the Senate, that I would handle the matter in the House Labor Committee, and he would table 2202 in the Judiciary Committee. That bill has been tabled, and what you see now are further amendments to 2202 to take care of the particular situation of the railroads and the utilities. So that's the status of why we've got this bill back again.
One thing I might point out is that Senate Bill 301 was introduced at the request of the Interim Committee on Trade and Economic Development. There was no opposition from either the plaintiff's bar or the defense bar. In fact, it was kind of rare to see them together on an issue.
Wrong.
Something must be wrong.
You know, Mr. O'Leary was the one that testified.
Yes, Mr. O'Leary, strong advocate for the Trial Lawyers Association.
Mr. Chairman, I see in the conflict report for 2202, there's another Senate bill, 309, that amends the same statute.
I'm not aware of that.
309? It's not in this committee, to my knowledge.
One other point, Mr. Chairman. The largest insurance carrier in the state perhaps might be able to give you some cost impact. They've had considerable experience over the years in this particular issue.
Mr. Bessnett's here.
Well, no, I was referring to the State Accident Insurance Fund, the largest mutual insurance company.
I didn't mean know that you were including both the public and the private insurance companies.
As a matter of fact, I've discussed this prior to the introduction of the bill with the counsel for the State Accident Insurance Fund. They're acutely aware of the problem, and I think they have some cost impact information they can give you if you happen to ask them.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I just want to make sure that I got this clearly embedded in my mind. But this would, all this bill does is just eliminate the ability of the third party employer to recover from the real employer.
That's correct, sir.
It does not eliminate the ability of the workman to go after the
third party. No, sir, it does not.
You don't have any objection to that?
No, none whatsoever.
Well, I think they have objections.
Well, if you want to get down to solving the product's liability problem, you can make workman's comp the exclusive remedy and not permit a third party action. I think that'd be an excellent idea.
Which
I think I might get some objections from the chairperson.
Okay.
Yes.
I have a question on this. Now, if the third party is sued, it is not under workman's comp.
That's correct.
It is under another, it's another form of liability. Now, tell me about the problems with that kind of liability coverage for an employer.
Well, that's under the public liability or general liability areas, it occurs actually most of the time, I believe, as a result of automotive accidents, where someone is injured in an automotive accident, and as a result, they bring action against the third party. And if the third party is found to be negligent and liable, then under a statutorily determined distribution of benefits, the benefits are first, the attorney's fees are taken out.
Always the attorney's fees.
Yes, they're always out first. And then the worker gets 25% of the remainder, and then the remainder of that goes back to the carrier who insured the employer of the worker, and then if there's any extra, that goes back to the worker also.
You mean the insurer who provided the workman's compensation?
The workman's compensation coverage, correct.
Okay, so now in the illustration that you used, the painter dropping the bucket of paint, another workman being injured, if that, your employee is injured as a result of the negligence of that painting contractor, they're covered under your workman's compensation. But now, what kind of liability coverage does the painter have to have, painting contractor have to have, to protect himself?
It's now, public liability.
Just regular public liability.
Yes, sir.
Liability.
This bill,
we debated that last session, I do believe. Mm-hmm.
This bill merely returns the state of the law to what it was prior to September 1st, 1975.
Not completely, does it?
Well,
because up to that time, they could not sue the third party.
Yeah, well, it had never been tested, I guess, to the extent it had in these particular cases.
Carl, you know...
But we thought the law was, I should say.
You know, you've got... What I think confuses people, you've got two different ideas. You're talking about indemnification, and they're talking... The other people here are talking about joint supervision and control in a third-party lawsuit. And that's what they want to try and separate. And could you explain that this bill does nothing to what we did last session in Senate Bill 181? And you're talking of a different type of a situation.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with joint supervision and control, but prior to last session, as the chairperson indicated, if there was a commingling of employees, even if there were more than one employer involved, then of course you could not bring the lawsuit against the third party in that case. It has nothing to do with that aspect of the law. Or perhaps in the situation that Roy gave, you could not bring the third party action if there was a commingling of employees because of the joint supervision and control defense. But we're not touching that. Love to, but we're not.
You know, Roy, the attorney fee, you know, that you talked about, I understand the attorneys have copied that from insurance agents and the way they determine it. It's sort of the very same. That's
right off the top.
That's very actionable, Roy.
Thank you very much. Carl, can I ask you a question?
Surely.
Are B and C the amendments that the utilities proposed?
Yes.
In the Senate?
Yes. Let me ask this question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What was the concern of the utilities?
You'll have to ask the utilities. Apparently they had a number of sidetrack agreements and special agreements regarding right-of-ways and this type of thing, a unique situation that other employers did not experience in their everyday business activities. And as a consequence, they were very dependent on these particular types of agreements. They wanted an exemption, and they were able to say they didn't want to kill a bill, so I said yes.
No, you know, okay, Mr. Kester's here. He didn't sign up. Why don't we get him up here? Because I was looking for Ray or somebody.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mr. Lenny Lumen Miller, Oregon Railroad Association. There's a tradition which I'm sure George, Representative Starr, is familiar with. In connection with our common carrier, I'm speaking for the railroads, service to local industry where we have sidetracks and spurs onto their property. We have written agreements with them in connection with liability which may be incurred in operating on their property through no fault of the railroad, so that if someone is hurt, a railroad employee or another person in the operation of the railroad in serving such a plant through some circumstance that is not our fault, then if the injured person sues the railroad, collects, the railroad by the written agreement with person, the company, can bring action against the company for whatever damage the court would decide is reimbursable to the railroads. Do I make myself clear? In other words, it's a written agreement. It's not, and it has to do with the provision. As a common carrier, we have to give service to the plants, and so this is the protection that's been traditional. We have hundreds of them. Another example would be a case where I'm not an attorney, so I'm a lot of my water, but we've had bills, several of you must know, through the years that touch on this area as far as railroads are concerned, where we operate with these indemnity agreements. Sometimes it has to do with a private crossing where the railroad crosses into a plant, and again, there's a written agreement as to the liability restrictions on
Lumen, is that found in chapter 757 and 760 of ORS?
I can find out for you.
No, the reason is I noticed the bill says that, which is subject to regulation pursuant to ORS 757 or 760.
There's the one paragraph in the bill that just specifically voids is the one that really disturbs our practice. And the same paragraph, the voiding paragraph, appears in both bills in exactly the same language, and that was our concern.
If I read B and C together, it says that this section, subsection, shall not apply to claims for indemnity or contribution asserted by a corporation, individual, or association of individuals, and the qualification, which is subject to regulation pursuant to ORS Chapter 757-760. That's the PUC.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so then you're basically talking about all those corporations, individuals, or associations of individuals that are regulated by the PUC.
Exactly. There was some suggestion, I, of course, do not write language for amendments, that it simply states those companies that are under PUC regulation are exempt, but that didn't seem to suit people, so they did write in utilities and railroads in the amendment. But that is my understanding of the restriction, or the exemption applies to those who have, you know, a common carrier obligation. In other words, we can't select our customers. We have to serve them all, and it's because of that that the written indemnity agreement is part and parcel of the operation.
And then sub C merely states that if there is a corporation, individual, or association of individuals which is not covered pursuant to the ORS Chapter 757 or 760, and they have such an agreement, that such an agreement would then be void.
That's the way I understand it. I don't want to be
wrong,
because all I know is that the language that there, we feel it's a little subject to misinterpretation, because it does spell out utilities and railroads, but the reason it was done that was, I believe, to recognize that we do have this particular problem where we are required to provide the service and therefore have reason to enter into written. These are voluntary agreements, I mean, that are made at the time the service is started, and they're enforced from then on.
No, it's much broader than just railroads. I want you to know that.
I don't want to speak for some of the other utilities, because they have very different, but I believe the power companies have some of these agreements in connection with their rights of way with power lines and that kind of thing.
Ray's here. Ray, do you want to testify on this forum, Bill?
We would have some of the same agreement.
Right away. I have one question.
Yeah.
I had an experience where I was injured on a train. It was on a main line. It wasn't on a company spur, but it was because of a low-hanging telephone wire that was down lower than it should have been, and I got hit by this wire and was injured. Nothing serious, and it wasn't permanent, so I was glad of that. Now, when I made a settlement for my time lost, nobody complained on it. The railroad claim agent said, "Well, we'll settle it, or if you want to go to the utility, either way, it didn't make any difference." So I went to the utility's insurance company, and they promptly settled it. Now, had I settled with the railroad company, then this language here would have protected their right to recover from the utility company. Is that correct?
I believe so, if they had an agreement with the utility.
This was a situation where it wasn't an industrial spur, it was just an overhead.
Well, I'm not sure of the
condition.
I presume that overhead wires, things like that, are covered. One of the examples that was used in the other hearing was the case where, and I believe there was a circumstance where, switching into a plant, there was some lumber left right on the edge of the track by some of the people employed by the plant, a pile, helter-skelter, and as the locomotive cleared it, it hit one of the boards, which swung around and injured one of the fellows on the locomotive. He, of course, was able to collect from the railroad for this injury, and the railroad, in turn, under its agreement with the company, was able to recover for them because it was their employee that left the lumber. I mean, that kind of
and that's what this accepting language preserves, that right. Is that correct?
That's
that ability.
What, yes, that's what we do not want, that kind of an agreement that made illegal.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Norman. Tom Bessnett. Tom, let me ask you a question before you sit down. These indemnification agreements, I'm sorry, before you start, these indemnification agreements, they're contractual. It isn't a common law right, is it? It's a contractual agreement by which a party agrees to indemnify, let me say the third party agrees to indemnify the employer if in fact if there's an injury from the result, whatever it is. Isn't that the situation that arises? And what you have is, in the workman's comp area, what you out of that Kaiser case, that you had the workman, or the, no, the employer going against the third party under its indemnification agreement, and it's just a group of insurance lawyers with the third party claimant. Actually, there's no money coming to the claimant himself. It's just all transpiring between the insurance carriers, with the lawyers getting wealthy on their time. Do I understand that correct?
Yeah. There is no additional money coming to the injured plaintiff.
Yeah. Okay.
My name is Tom Bessonette with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. The plaintiff receives the amount of the original award. The rest of the action is between the insurance companies and the attorneys, and we're trying to cut out one of those actions by the support of this bill. Now, I come in from a little different angle.
What action is that?
The action, the indemnification or the contribution action. That's just between two insurance companies as a rule, unless one employer might not have insurance for some reason. And then there's two more attorneys employed. And so we're actually trying to cut out that one action, which the court gave right to, not the legislature, in their decision. Now, I come in from this from the standpoint that I represent a liability insurance carrier only. In other words, we write the comprehensive general liability on people. We do not write workman's compensation. On first blush, it would appear that we might have some reservations about this type of legislation being adverse to our policyholders' interests. But in equity and in fairness to everybody, we feel that we should support this type of legislation instead of opposing. So we add our support to it.
If I remember correctly, this was the identical situation that related that existed with the what was that, Harbor and Longshoreman, prior to 72, and then Congress passed a law specifically like this to exempt those type of lawsuits.
You'll have
and then
to.
The Oregon Supreme Court picked it up here and went 74, 75, and put it into that case. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gill, do you want to say anything? Since Mr. Frederick volunteered your services to the committee.
I'm Chuck Gill, a manager of State Axe Insurance Company, the largest company in the state of Oregon. This is Keith Maloney, counsel. We certainly endorse the bill, and just as a point of interest, since the case came down in 75, we've had 17 cases, maybe more right now, that involve the action over in amounts of ranging from $54,000 to $2.3 million of actions brought. A substantial amount of money, and these cases can be very, very expensive. Not only that, they're very difficult to handle from a legal standpoint. They create an awful lot of problems for the carriers and for the employers if by any chance he does not have the type of coverage to take care of this kind of indemnity. There are some other factors in it that Mr. Maloney, I think, might point out to the committee. He's been involved in this this type of legal work for many years and probably could clear up a couple of things.
Go right ahead.
Yes, at one point you were suggesting that these were all written agreements. There's two kinds of indemnity cases, express and implied. USF&G versus Kaiser case was, there was no written agreement at all. It was based on an implied warranty that the employer would use a piece of machinery in the proper manner. And so you do have the two kinds of indemnity agreements, the ones where there is a written hold harmless agreement, like the railroads and the utilities, and then you have the additional liability, which is based on a breach of an implied warranty that you'll do this work or use this machine in a proper manner. So this bill voids both the express and the implied warranties, with the exception of the utilities, and it gives them both.
That phrase that appears on lines 17 and 18 where it says all agreements are warranties picks up everything, you think?
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Does anyone have a motion on this bill? Chair would entertain a motion.
I'll move this bill to the floor.
Representative Starr moves that Engross Senate Bill 301 be sent to the floor with a dispatch recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelms?
Aye.
Chairperson Kulongoski?
Aye. Senate Bill 301 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry the bill. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on that? Senate Bill 423. The chair is going to appoint a subcommittee of one of Representative Otto to meet with all interested parties on this to try to work out subparagraph D. Luther Moody, I think that at this particular time, the only one that signed up, and what I would be prepared to do is to have you wait and go to the meeting when Representative Otto calls it. It's the chair's feeling about the bill, that listening to the testimony, that other than what Representative Rogers pointed out on page 3, subsection 1, as far as the length of a sentence, once legislative council is working on that to rephrase that so that it is much more understandable, but it appeared that there was not much dispute as to the purposes and intent of the changes in the law on page 3 in ORS 654.082. It seems that the controversy in the bill is centered around sub D on page 2. It's my feeling, and this is just the chair, and I'm going to let Representative Otto work on it, that is an issue which I really don't know if we're going to be able to compromise, because you're either going to allow an individual a private cause of action in that situation or you're not. And I think you can move the language around all you want, and you can attempt to draft it so it's very restrictive, but still I think you have to answer the threshold question of whether we're going to further expand the concept, or I should say that we're going to further move into the area of the exclusive remedy of workman's compensation. And I would ask the Representative Otto, when he works with the subcommittee, if he would look at the possibility instead of, and Luther, I'm saying this for you so you can tell Dick, because I'm going to have lunch with him and talk to him, of whether in fact that in that situation maybe the better thing to do is to look at the penalty provisions under the safety OSHA. In other words, if you want to go and you think that that is that important of an issue that the legislature wants to look at, I think that you can look at fines that would be rather considerable. And I'm talking of a fine of maybe $5,000 to $10,000 to the employer, as that is an alternative to putting sub D into the law, which is moving away from the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation. And I thought about this for some time, and even though I personally feel that it's a very serious situation, I am concerned that if we keep, as we did last session with the red tag in this particular provision, that we're going to eventually emasculate the exclusive remedy concept of workers' compensation. So I would rather look at it as a safety problem rather than as a workers' compensation type situation. Now, if that is any suggestion. Okay. Representative Otto will set the time and the hearing for that when he so desires. I'm going to close the hearing on 423. The next two bills up, the first one is House Bill 2656. Now, I would like, I'm going to bring up, since both people have signed up for both bills, it's rather interesting. Mr. Randall and Mr. Lawrence, Mr. Randall represents the Oregon AFL-CIO, and Mr. Lawrence represents the Gibbons Company, which represents a number of employers in this area of unemployment compensation. That it's interesting that they both, they're the only two people that signed up on the bill, but they're just opposite. On the maximum benefits increase, Mr. Randall is for that, Mr. Lawrence is against it, and on the bill to restrict voluntary quits to compensation, Mr. Randall's against it, Mr. Lawrence is for it. Now, what I would like to do with both of these bills is for the committee to look at them as somewhat of a quid pro quo. Now, maybe the parties will not, but maybe that the committee could understand and look at it in the sense that if there's going to be an increase in benefits, then a voluntary quit bill is going to come out. And I, one of the things I do not have, and it's my fault, is that when I started working on it, I have not got a cost estimate or an anticipated expenditure saving to the employers if the voluntary quit bill passes. I don't know how much money that the employers would save under that, and what I guess I'm getting at, Ross, is whether the fact that the money, the people who would be disqualified under the voluntary quit bill, that the benefits they would receive will offset any benefit increase that would transpire because of an increase in the maximum benefits to 60%. Have you got that figure? Well, why don't I do this? If you could, if the committee would look at 2656 and 2398 together, and here's, if you will look at 2398, this is the maximum benefit bill, and there is a particular provision, an amendment in your bill book, if you will look at it. There's a mocked-up version of the bill. If you look at the very first one where it says proposed amendments to House Bill 2398, and these were the amendments that were proposed by the Oregon State AFL-CIO. And what the amendments do is they move to 60% maximum benefit, but they do it in a two-year increment. And if you look over on page 3 of the mocked-up version, on line 11, you'll note that sub B starts out 57.5% of the state average weekly wage from the preceding calendar year. And then there's a new insert that says 60% of the state average, it's a C, it says 60% of the state average weekly wage covered for the preceding calendar year effective. So they've got it in a two-year increment. Do you have that? It's in the front of the bill book of 2398.
Oh. I haven't been able to locate a mock-up. Oh, here it is. Okay. All right. Just to the five-bill part.
Okay.
This is one that has one the top proposed amendments. No date on it?
No, yeah, they're the ones that have proposed amendments on. Now, also on that page, and I'm going to ask Libby if I'm correct, sub C has been deleted. That's the little sub C, if I'm not mistaken. On page 3 of 2398. It was.
Mm.
I don't know if it's ever been actually deleted or not. Libby, why don't you come on up here?
Okay, Libby.
Adopted on 318 in that same sequence of 2398, if you look at the bill itself, the committee has marked on that bill those amendments that have been deleted. So adopted. Got it.
Okay.
Now, Libby, the first question I've got to ask you, I want to ask you, is that have we got cost figures in the book now from you on the amended version of 2398 as far as the year and a half and year and a half? I mean, two and a half and two and a half increment.
I have Libby Leonard, Supervisor Benefits Employment Division. I think possibly Ross would want to speak to this. We have some figures. Whether or not they've been presented to the committee or not, I am not aware.
Ross, why don't you go once again to the figures you have on 2398 and let us know if, in fact, they're broken down into the two and a half and two and a half increment.
Yes, they are. Mr.
Okay,
Chairman,
go ahead.
I don't know whether this is presented to the committee or not, but we have a sheet that I don't know how many copies of it we have.
But if you use this, I'll give my
phone. Anyway, we had a breakdown on the 20% to 60%. We got a breakdown on the 25 and 57.5 and 25 to 60%. And that figure there shows for the 77-79 biennium. An estimate of $26,420,000.
$26 million?
Yeah, $420,000.
Okay, now how much is that above what will currently be paid out under the 55? Is that?
That's the addition. That's the additional cost to employers.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Gary.
I am lost.
Okay.
77-79. $26 million.
$26,420,000. $26 million. $420,000.
And that's at the step?
That's stepping it up 2.5% each year.
Okay, now what I want to know, Ross, is how much of that is on the 2.5 increase on the maximum, and how much is it at the increase on the 25 from 15% to 25%?
Well, I don't have that breakout. I think it's possible to get it because they had to go through that in order to come up with this figure. I could probably get it. But you have to know that the amount of money involved in changing the lower minimum is not the major part. That's a small part. Okay. I can't give you the percentage, but I know that it wouldn't be more than 10 to 15% of it at the most.
Does everyone have the sheet dated April 19, 1977?
Mm-hmm.
Does everyone have a copy of that? Ross, that's what we're looking at. And I'm going to go down here to 20.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
On that thing, that doesn't indicate a $26 million.
No, that's what I'm going to try and get to him, because I think he's got a way of figuring that out.
This is what they're
looking at. Mr. Chairman, there is a more later dated one, and she's getting copies.
Why don't we just wait, and the committee will stand in recess until that comes.
Yeah. Committee will come to order. The party will not vote present. All of us are excused.
Hello, Ed. Yeah, I have one for myself.
You what?
Do you need any extras?
I need to go ahead.
I can get some made later. Marla gets back. Do you need one?
Ross, when you look at that now, before Gary gets here, let me get him in here.
On the breakout of the $26,420,000, which is the latest figure of what it would cost to make the 2.5 and the 2.5 and using a minimum of 25%. And from that $26,420,000, $7 million of that is due to the increase in the to 25% on the minimum. If you were to make it 20% instead of 25%, the cost would be $4.8 million, and of course, on the maximum side, would remain the same.
$4.8 million if it were 20%?
If it were 20%, it'd be $4.8 million. At 25%, it's $7
million. Okay.
No, I'm sorry, Ross. Where's that at again?
Under C, on that.
Okay.
All right, now, you asked about the breakout.
Yeah.
So what did it cost to raise the minimum? The 25% cost $7 million.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Of the 26, $7 million is ascribable to 25%. If you were to lower that to 20%, the cost would be $4.8 million.
Okay. Okay. So actually, if I understand, let me look at this. We're looking at...
I'll get you. Okay.
So the total cost of that package then is $26,420,000.
That's right.
25.
That's right.
For the biennium, if we go to 20 and 57.5, it's $19 million. And then for
the difference between 4.8 and 7 is the only...
Oh, I'm the total cost.
Total cost, you deduct... if you went to 20%, what would this...
That would be roughly $21.2 million. In other words, for the maximum and the minimum.
Not that much. It would be more than that. Difference between 4.8 and 7.
I'm
2.2. Bill,
I hate to slow things down here, but let's go back to the original starting point. We're looking at this chart dated May 4th,
right?
77, and down at C.
Yeah.
And there's $26,420,000 for 7779?
That's right.
Okay. And of that, $4.8 million.
No, $7 million of that.
No, let me take it in steps.
All right.
$4.8 million of that is in going to 20%. And then an additional $2.2 million is taking it on up to 25%.
No. No.
I got a nod and I got a no.
Safe. Out.
This is one of the benefits of being the senior umpire for us.
Where's the 19.2 come from?
Don't you ever see an umpire do that? One guy goes,
Amazement,
and then take a vote.
Didn't you say it'd be reduced by that?
I'll take whatever they say.
I think Representative Rogers has pocket calculated.
That you use the 4.8.
At a particular time, a third this party disinterested would be appointed by both management,
okay.
Labor,
I
Libby.
I think I'm straight.
Am I correct at that stage now?
All right.
Okay. So there is.
You are correct or you're not correct?
Well,
it is correct.
I am.
Let him say it again if he could, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Okay.
No, I think it's a good analysis.
I'll restate it. We're starting out on C with 26.42 million, and of that, if we instead of 25%, it was 20%, there would be 4.8 that of this takes it to 20%. Then taking it on up to 25% adds another 2.2 for a total of $7 million. So if we left it at 15% on the bottom, we're really talking about $19,420,000. Okay. Now that takes care of 77.79. Now as we move on over to 79.81, you have the same sort of figures for us?
I don't have the breakout of the minimum maximum. Or the 8081.
Okay, because now we've jumped up $4 million, but that's because of now we're in a solid 60%. Can we assume at that time that of that $30 million, that $7 million of it, or roughly $7 million of it, is due to increasing from 15% to 25%?
It'd be a little more than that because your percentage is going to raise the amount of money.
Okay, because it's for the full 2 years instead of just part of the 2 years.
Yeah.
So actually, it's $7 million plus.
That's right.
And you don't know quite how much the plus is.
No.
Okay. All right. Now, I've got another question to get away from the cost on this, and maybe the rest of the committee doesn't want to leave the cost yet, but I would want to know, we were given figures on what the minimum benefit would be at 15%, minimum benefit at 20%. Now, do you have the figures on the minimum benefit at 25%?
I believe they're shown there, Representative Rogers, in the parentheses.
Oh, okay. That's what that...
Came on the right-hand side.
That's what that $58 represents.
The 51 and the 55.
Yeah, and 58 and 63.
Right.
Okay. But now this minimum benefit is based... The person could draw no less than that minimum benefit.
Correct.
Is it conceivable that at a $58 a week minimum benefit level, that the person would be getting more than their average wage had been for the qualification period?
Yes, this would be possible because it depends on how their earnings were. In other words, if you'd assume that person only made $700 or $1,000, depending on whether or not you, right? when the other bill is passed, in 18 weeks, then they'd be working maybe one or two days a week, ordinarily. They got a part-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost it. This $58 or $51 or whatever it's going to be could very much easily be more than they were getting before.
Okay, now, we also had previously, if I'm correct, that if we go to 20%, that will, under current laws, as far as you knew, we will then be paying the highest minimum of any of the 50 states?
Yes, we would.
At 20%?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Go right ahead.
At what point do we take care of the problem of the possibility of a person being able to draw more on benefits than they than their average wage was? At what percentage would we cut that problem off, or would we? Does that exist today?
I think it could.
It could, depending on how the person works. What kind of work do they have? When you get to these minimums, you're talking about, you see, they've got to be over $700 if they make $2.30 and work full-time. They're going to make a lot more than $700. So if when you get down to that minimum, now there aren't too many of those, let's be honest about it. There aren't a lot of people that are drawing at that very minimum rate. But you ask, is it possible? And yes, it is.
Are we going to compound the problem if we increase?
Well, there's going to be more of it if you do this.
There may not be many of them, but they sure add up to some bucks in a hurry.
Do we, never mind.
Most of the people at the minimum amount usually exhaust their claim before they find another job.
Well, at 15%, where do we stand in relationship to the rest of the country?
I think we're third highest now at 15.
There's a chart in your book here from the Quickie Research Company. I have to assume that that's relatively accurate. Or maybe it's not in your book. No, this is something that I had gotten, some data that I had gotten. But,
Well, Ross, let me ask you this. How many states are on the percentage and how many are on the fixed dollar?
I think the Libby has that, I think.
Well, I don't have it summarized. I have the data here from which I could gather it.
Okay, Libby, I guess, you know, when you say the third highest, is that, I didn't understand that.
In dollars. In dollars.
In dollars. That's in dollars?
In dollars.
In other words, our minimum benefit right now is $28.
That's right.
And that is the third highest in the country.
Yeah.
Right.
For 28.
I can give you the exact. Indiana pays $35 as a minimum weekly benefit amount. California pays $30, and Oregon pays $28.
Where's the range? Where would be the mean?
I'd say between $11 and $20. I've broken them out in $5 increments.
Oh, okay.
You want the 10%?
Here's 22 states are listed on this particular chart, and the range is, looks like $10 is the lowest. They range up, there are a lot of them around 15 and 16. There's some that are variable.
Hawaii pays $5 a week.
Okay, Hawaii's not on this one, so. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It is on this one, and I overlooked that. It was so low, I missed it. Okay.
You've got 9 states that pay between $6 and $10 a week.
Mm-hmm.
You've got 20 states that pay between $11 and $15. And then 14 states pay between $16 and $20. Mm-hmm. Then over $20, you only have 8 states. Let's say over $20.
Okay. Well, where are we in maximum now?
mean, where are we compared to other states? About the middle of the range.
There's 19 states that pay more at the maximum than we do.
At 60%, where would we be?
I should have brought the chart.
Well, you don't know yet until you find out what other legislatures have done this.
That's another thing.
That's
there's a lot of movement going on.
Yeah.
And that's why I said presently.
If everybody else stayed the same, there would be 10 states that would pay more than we did if we went 60% July 4th.
So you can assume that there will be more than that because of legislative action.
And this is, Representative, this is strictly on the benefit program. Now, this doesn't include any dependents allowance or
I was going to get to that. Oregon doesn't have that concept.
I think there's only three states that do.
No, is that all?
That's all.
Two or three?
Yeah, it creates different problems. That's why states have to talk much to it.
No, but I mean, it is an additional benefit to some people.
In some states, yeah. Pennsylvania, I think, principally.
Okay, so we've got a total, if we go to 2057 and a half this next year, you've got, what was the figure again, 21?
If you go to
2057 and a half this year.
The amount of the cost?
Yes.
19 million? Is that under
plan B?
Well, I worked with that.
Yeah, it's at $19 million.
Okay.
But the dates may be off here, so our figures may be off. But when do you start?
Yeah, that's...
will make a difference.
Okay. Okay. Now, if I could, because we're talking about both bills, I want to talk about the voluntary quit bill. As far as if a bill were passed so that maybe that the bill were passed the way it's written, except that we've got that first sentence of the proposed amendments rather than all the other parts. Do you have any estimate of how much money that will save? Okay, would you look, while we're at it, would you look at House Bill 2656 in your books?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask one more question on this before we go to 2056? Can you project what effect that this will have on the fund as far as the length of time that the fund adequacy percentage ratio would be such that employers are going to be at the maximum tax rate?
Yeah, that's our second page of what they just made. I don't have it.
And Ross, this doesn't show 25% minimum. It just goes to 20, 57, and 60. So I don't know what 25 would delay it a little longer.
You have one?
No. Well, wait. No, I think maybe we do have one.
I think you got this in there.
That looks familiar.
You have a lot of that in the bill.
Right. That looks familiar.
At any rate, the increase will...
No, I don't have it in here anyway.
Well, let's take a look at it. You can see how much longer we stay at table 8.
No.
This is where we want to get down over here.
Here, you got it, Gary. April 19th.
Yeah,
the expected impact to House Bill 2398. This one?
It starts off with benefits and taxes, two columns, Representative
Bob. Right. Might have taken it out.
Well, no, the book should, even if you took it, I'd put a copy of anything they gave us in the book. So.
This is the one you're talking about, April 19th.
I might have taken it out of here once before and took it up to my office.
Yeah, that
probably what I did.
Well, I had my folder.
Wait, I want to understand this now.
be on 2398?
Yeah.
You'd actually stay.
See, if we
now,
stay,
this is where we're at
here
now.
Here we are now. We're going to go.
Very different.
David, you're here. You've got it right
this
here.
Yeah, I got it.
This is 81.
We're
going to
trigger out. I've got it in my folder.
Tables. Okay. So what's going to happen over here is you're going to stay at the third.
All of
your numbers. All of your numbers. That's
what I thought. Is this reflective of how much more will be?
I've got a whistle at my house that I used to call my hunting dogs, and it doesn't make any noise.
Here.
Would you rather have one like that?
The only problem is my staff won't be able to hear that one.
Well, that's why.
And they'll never be able to come and defend me.
I see, okay.
When it's happening.
Well, I want to make some notes on it. Thanks.
Okay.
They're awful nice folks, those people from the plant.
They happen to have a lot of people.
Okay. Now, Libby, the question I ask you is that have you got a look at 2656, excuse me, of an anticipated cost savings with that bill?
Well, now you're talking about 2656 with a proposed amendment.
Now, which proposed amendment is that?
Okay, you had a sheet on your thing.
Okay.
It's the sheet that stated 531.
Okay.
So it appears to me that the main difference in what we're doing now and what we would do under this proposed amendment would be that we would be paying those people who leave to accompany or join a spouse, which we are not doing now. Otherwise, we do give good cause in most cases if you leave work due to illness, injury, or disability, and so forth.
Okay. Wait, are you telling me that if, in fact, that sentence were deleted, that you would still interpret the and be applying that as if that wasn't there?
Except for the leaving to accompany or join a spouse.
Yes,
I would. If you just had the first sentence and none of the rest of it, we wouldn't change anything we're doing now.
Okay. Now,
first sentence is what? This?
Yes, okay, so I delete that particular sentence. And the only difference in it is that the bill is passed, which says that a person who voluntarily quits their... up here where it says the individual voluntarily left work without good cause, that if he was found to have left work without good cause, that he could not draw unemployment benefits unless he worked for 4 weeks after that. Now, under that situation, do you have a cost savings on that idea?
Now, are you saying that if he was discharged for misconduct?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right, well, then I would... And we're leaving out this accompany spouse thing completely?
Yeah. Right now, I want you to apply the law like you are interpreting it right now. The only difference is, under the present law, that if he waits 8 weeks, he can draw.
Right.
But the way this bill would pass is that he wouldn't be able to do that until he worked for 4 weeks.
$37 million.
Fiscal impact.
We would have a decrease in benefits paid of $37 million, you've just described it.
Well, that's like the original bill, then, you're talking about.
Well, no, the only difference is the original bill was 6 weeks, and this is four.
Okay, let's see. That would make a difference.
All right, but now,
Let me just a second. Glenn?
Now, the law is 8 weeks. And or 2 weeks, right?
Or four.
Okay. Four. Either work 4 weeks or you sign up for 8 weeks.
That's the way it is now.
Or a combination.
All right. Now, the story I heard when we took our trip around the state, you can quit, be off a couple of weeks, work a couple of weeks and be on, and then quit and then be on unemployment.
That's not correct.
That's not
domestic, correct. Well, if you quit, okay. If you quit For a marital domestic reason, to accompany your spouse or something like that, all you have to do is have 1 week's work to requalify.
Everybody else 4 weeks, but a domestic quit under the present law is 1 week of work.
Or 8 weeks, you could sign off in 8 weeks.
But any other reason, you could quit. Say that I quit on a Friday, one employer, voluntary quit, and go to work for, how many weeks would I have to work for another employer before I could go for?
If you quit without good cause, for some reason that wasn't marital domestic, you'd have to work 4 weeks to draw on before you could draw on employment. Or you would have to sign up in our office 8 weeks.
Okay. But now if a person, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, well, I'll ask you anyway. If a person quit, as in the case of Representative Otto cited, and then worked 4 weeks, and then quit, he'd be disqualified and would have to work four more.
It's his last separation from work where he had at least 4 weeks. If you come into our office and file a claim and said you just got laid off, but you only worked for your last employer 2 weeks, and it turned out that you had quit your prior job, you could still suffer a disqualification.
Right. Well, could or would.
You would if it was a quit without good cause.
And then if I went to work for another employer for 2 more weeks and got laid off from that one, then I would qualify.
That's right. You have to have 4 weeks of subsequent work after any disqualifying separation.
Yeah. But you don't have a fiscal impact on this bill with these amendments.
No.
Not with those amendments, no. I do know how many disqualifications we issued under to accompany or join a spouse in calendar year 1976. And that we would not have issued those under these proposed amendments.
Yeah, under these amendments, how would the person who quits to accompany their spouse be affected?
Well, with these amendments, the way I read them, it would be considered to be good cause, and they wouldn't be disqualified.
Let me, if I could, Gary, you know, it's a difficult area to understand when reading the statute. If you would look at the bill, the sub 3, now what is the current status of the law reading sub 3 of the proposed amendments? If an individual left work to be married, or if an individual left work to accompany his or her spouse or companion or joint or companion or joint him or
keep it clean.
Okay, C, the individual left work because of her marital status or domestic duties. If you fall into A, B, or C, that is in essence not good cause.
No, we don't call it not good cause, Mr. Chairman. We say that it may have been good cause under sub 2C above, but it is disqualifying under sub 3.
Okay. Now, if in fact we adopt the amendment, let's just assume the proposed amendment, we would have to delete A, B, and C under sub 3.
Well, I don't know that you'd have to, but if you say that it's going to be good cause to accompany or join a spouse at a place where it's impractical to accept and transfer commute to such work in one part of the law, and then you say that it's going to be disqualifying to leave work because of your marital status, it seems to me you have a slight problem.
That's why I said that if we adopt the amendment, we have to delete that from that section.
All right.
Now, let me ask you, if you keep 3 as it presently is in the statute,
yes,
and you do not adopt the amendment, except, you know, the big one on the side, and you do not, what is the change in the law as far as how you interpret it?
You're saying we do not adopt the big one on the side?
Yeah, we do not adopt the big one on the side, but we keep three just as it is.
All you do is knock out the 8-week satisfaction.
That's right.
All right. Now, the only figure now you want to know about money.
Well, I want to know both. I want to know money, and I want to know how you're going to interpret that.
Well, I would interpret the law the way I am doing right now, which would be good cause, would be you're talking about whether or not personal reasons would be good cause.
That's what I'm asking.
We have areas.
I know. That's exactly the case at worries me.
And we have found that some things which are could be considered of a personal nature can be objectively related to the work, such as a person who is seriously ill and can no longer work. We figure that's objectively related to the work, and we call it good cause.
Except they cannot draw benefits if they
not until they're able
until
to work.
They're able
if
to work.
They
okay.
could quit and then okay. 6 months later or 2 months or whatever.
Okay, let me ask you one more situation in this whole exchange. If I were to, you were to keep 3 as it is, but delete sub B from the section so that A and C remain, but sub B is deleted.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that would do with the division's interpretation of that section as far as leaving work to accompany his or her spouse?
I think I'll defer that to the policymaker.
I don't think I understand what would happen.
If you take out the disqualification for leaving to accompany the spouse and you don't put in a positive statement that it is good cause, what would we do with it?
That's right. That's exactly it.
Well, we got a problem with the Arias case. I think either way, and I think if it's a legislature's wish that the Arias case is wrong, in other words, that's taking too strict an interpretation, which is, I don't know how many of you read that, but that was Jake Tanzer's opinion that it had to be work-related, and we've not been interpreting quite that strictly. You could take a very strict interpretation of that if you wanted to, and it could be a lot tougher than what it is. But if you really want to go away from that strict interpretation, the agency needs that first sentence in your side, the authorized representative designated by the administrator may consider employment-related as well as non-employment-related reasons in determining whether an individual left work without good cause. We need that sentence if it's the wish of the legislature to go away from Aries.
Okay, now, Ross.
Now, we haven't been interpreting Aries very strictly, but it's still there, and it can go on. Somebody, when we take a lenient stand on it, it jolly well can go on up through the appeals and get back to court again.
One further point on that, and one reason why we haven't been doing it as strictly as it may have been, as it may be construed, is that in another part of our law, in 657471, we can relieve an employer's account if a person voluntarily quits with good cause not attributable to the employer. And so we have been saying the legislature must have assumed that there would be some reasons which weren't attributable to the employer, and therefore we're finding some.
Well, let me just tell you, the problems I have, one with the proposed amendment on the side, and to give you an idea, if you just take the first sentence, I've looked at that, and that is an extremely broad grant of power with no standard to the administrative agency. And I worry about that. I do not believe that that's good legislation to do that, just as a policy matter. Secondly, if I don't enumerate the specific situations that I'm talking about, and I word it in the sense that it's for reasonable cause or for, you know, the standard, the reasonable man standard, what I'm going to do then is defer to the court to decide what is the reasonable man standard. And I don't want the court to do that. So what I'm looking at is some way to get around the Arias case and still be able to have a standard for you to apply that isn't so broad
that we're going to pick up every non-job-related reason for leaving and put it into the statute. Now, I would really believe that if I just adopted the first sentence and nothing else, the employers would really have a concern about what you were going to do. Now, I have a good trust in your judgment, Mr. Morgan, believe me, and your division, but I know that you're not going to be there all the time, and I could see that this would become a political football as to whoever's going to be there, as for how they're going to interpret that. And I could get an administrator in there that would say, by golly, I'll tell you how I'm going to interpret that. Job-related, that's it, period. And then I could get another guy in there that's going to say, listen, I think everybody should be on unemployment if they're not working. And then they say every reason that guy left the job was, was compensable. And I just don't, I think there's got to be some other grounds in the middle of this thing that we can work this out.
I agree with you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Ed Northcutt with the Employment Division. Well, until the Arias case came along, we had been using the terminology left work without good cause as the basis for disqualification for probably some 35, 40 years. And I don't know of anything that would be any more broad or than just the terminology left work without good cause.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Gary?
What is voluntarily leaving work with good cause?
It could be something to do with the work itself where the conditions of work were injurious to your health, safety, or morals, something like that. It could be a personal reason such as where you would have no alternative but to leave. And there again, you fall back on illness or injury.
But there are voluntary quits with good cause.
That's right.
All right, now how do they qualify under the existing? If they voluntarily leave with good cause,
they just get paid.
They get
no
paid.
They're immediately after the waiting week.
And there's lots of them.
There's lots of them.
Right. Yeah.
They don't have to requalify in any manner. Seems like it would be nice if we could have a scale. In the law, you know, if a guy gets a can, you just don't get anything. And if you voluntarily leave, you know, without good cause, then you work 6 weeks. And then if you voluntarily leave with good cause, maybe you got to work 3. And then if you get laid off, you're immediately qualified or something. Well, why can't we do something like that? Because I know the AFL-CIO is concerned about the person that, you know, that gets mad and quits because he can't stand his boss anymore. I haven't got too much sympathy for him, but I don't think he ought to be treated the same as somebody that's discharged for, you know, this can. Or it's discharged for misconduct or something like that, you know. But the law doesn't seem to have its priorities very well established. It seems like maybe we could do a better job weighing this out in some kind of a situation. How does the federal law deal with this? I mean, what kind of mandates do we have on us?
No mandate.
No mandate.
So, in fact, if we wanted to exclude a guy that was canned for misconduct, we could do that.
That's right.
And scale down there.
You can be as lenient or as tough on this part of the law. The feds, they might comment, but there's no guideline.
Mr. Chairman, on anything other than fraud or some criminal activity, you can't take away the whole claim. You can forfeit up to all of the claim except $1. In other words, nobody's ever defined how much you have to leave there. But generally, I know of no state that has taken away 100% of the claim unless there was some criminal activity that was involved in the discharge.
I was just, you know, it might be a little severe to treat a guy that's fired that way, but it really does make sense that a person that's fired shouldn't necessarily be treated the same as a person that voluntarily quits.
Sometimes
without good cause, and then the person that quits with good cause maybe shouldn't be treated the same as the person that's actually laid off.
about 20 years ago, we had in the law a provision for a disqualification to vary from 5 to 9 weeks on the basis of the act involved in the discharge. And you would be surprised how much difficulty that created. In other words, whether you were going to put 6 weeks and what was the difference between the 5-week incident and the 6-week incident or the 9-week incident.
But you had flexibility to assign. If it was stipulated in the statute, you didn't have any flexibility other than determining where he fell in this place.
It's amazing how each case ends up being something just a little bit different. And that's why it's hard to put your people like, you know, quick answers that say this is covered or that's covered. And 8+ years I've been there, I am amazed by how many different kinds of cases come up, and each one is a little bit different, and you'd look at it differently. And it's awfully hard to say that these are the reasons that we're going to call it a good cause, and these are the ones we're not going. You can generalize somewhat, but every case has got to, if you're going to be equitable, you've got to look at every case as an individual thing.
Garrett, there's a real practical problem in this whole thing, and this is just from the experience and the type of work that I'm engaged in my practice. You're taking the situation in which the individual is having a problem and their work relationship with their employer. Under the present law, before that situation becomes so intolerable, what happens is the employee quits. And one of the reasons they quit is, I think, is because they know that they can go out and look for a job, but they can draw unemployment after 8 weeks. And if you draw too strict of a standard, what's going to happen is a practical matter. The employee's going to know he's not going to get unemployment. He's going to know then the only way he can get unemployment is to be fired. And so what's going to happen is the employee's going to sit there and start thinking, what do I have to do to get fired? And so that has a disastrous effect for two people. For the employer, he's got an employee that is in essence just screwing around, looking to get fired, probably disrupting the workforce, a variety of other things. But it also puts that employee in a position that he's going to have a fire on his work record. He's going to have been fired from a job. So I think it's just an impossible situation. I don't think the employers are going to benefit from that situation as a practical matter, because the employee, I really believe, will just sit back there and force the employer to fire him. And then the employee is going to have to live with that on his work record. But it's that narrow situation we're trying to address, in which there's a real legitimate reason for the person to quit the job. It may be a step short of being fired. It may be at the mutual convenience of both parties, the employer and the employee. Yes. But if we draw it too narrowly, I'm afraid that we're going to create a situation for both the employers and the employees that will not be good. And I might tell the committee one other thing, that I've been following the laws in the other state, and all the states that seem now to be going through reform in the unemployment area, the one thing that they hit on is the disqualification completely for voluntary quits. And there are a number of states this year that have adopted this approach.
Mr. Chairman, Bill, what you're saying is that you do not want a matrix like the parole board uses.
That's right. It's very hard to follow it.
You've got your own that you've developed by administrative policy and precedent over a number of years. I'm not, maybe I should be, but I'm really not uncomfortable with you having that first sentence in the law. That doesn't bother me as much as it seems to bother some of the other folks, because, you know, I...
The lawyer in me, Bill.
Yeah, but... You know, I look at past performance, and I know that things can shift, but you're also a pretty big bureaucracy, and bureaucracy shifts slowly. Now, I've got another question.
Go ahead, Bill.
There. I seem to recall, and I may be wrong on this, that on page 3 of the printed bill, if we leave that just exactly the way it is, that we can have some problem. Is that correct? Don't we have to, under any circumstance, under any circumstance, eventually have to pay someone to be in compliance with the federal law?
No.
No.
Okay, well, I misunderstood.
Okay. No.
What I said was that, in other words, there are some states that, as a condition of the disqualification, you forfeit or your total benefit amount is reduced by a certain number of weeks.
Yes, but...
And if I understood Representative Williams there, he was suggesting that maybe the whole claim be forfeited if you were discharged under certain conditions. And that is permissible only to the extent that you are discharged for some type of criminal...
Fraud.
Or fraud. If you have been involved in fraud and collecting unemployment benefits before.
Fraud, criminal...
Felony. Conviction of a felony or a fraud.
No. So I'm still a little bit confused on this on page 3, because if we adopt this as it is written and someone voluntarily leaves work without good cause and doesn't requalify under this on lines 20 through 28 on page 2, he would never be eligible.
That's right, but he has the opportunity, you see.
I see. As long as he has the opportunity.
As long as he has the opportunity.
Okay. Well, that's what... Okay, I had missed that point.
There's several states that have, in other words, like California, I don't know how long they've had it in the law, but they have had a requirement that you must work five and earn 5 times your weekly benefit amount, whether it be a discharge or a voluntary quit for some time.
Is that better than stating it in weeks the way we do?
I think it has the same net effect.
It's the same. Right. It means the same thing. Just stated.
Right. Right.
Okay. Well, that's you've given us over a period of a number of hearings and over quite a lengthy period of time things that you would and would not pay benefits on, and I think that based on the present law, you've administered it quite well, equitably. I may not agree with a couple of it, but and so that's the reason that I don't have any hang up about giving you that first sentence in these amendments and leaving it at that, and that would allow you to deal with the Aris case in a way that you are already doing, except that you are subject now to a challenge.
That's right. Mr. Chairman,
Ross.
Speaking to this voluntary quit, just a moment, please, if I could. Now, one of the things that a lot of people are concerned about in a voluntary quit is that and nobody can prove whether this is right or wrong, but a lot of people are quitting a job because they know the unemployment's available, and that they're not too concerned because there are a lot of second incomes and third incomes in families, and so they're not up against a wall as they would have been years ago. One of the benefits of tightening down the law somewhat is that people would take a second look, because you could have good cause if you tried to work out your problem with your boss if you had a problem. And maybe they take a second look and do a better job, because if they've searched out every way to stay on that job and they've done everything that anybody would prudently do to keep the job by going to a supervisor and saying, my foreman and I just don't get along. Is there some other way that you can, that I could, or some other place in the plant that I could work? If a search is made, rather than just getting up and quit because you have a problem with your supervisor, your foreman. If a real attempt is made to try to rectify the problem, we'd call that good cause for quitting. And so I think, and a lot of people don't know that could happen if they did it that way. They just get mad and they get up and they say, I'm going, and away they go.
Phil, let me, before you begin, there's a meeting in the governor's office right now, and what I'm going to do, since this is on the agenda, I'm going to, instead of adjourning the meeting this morning, I'm going to recess the meeting, and we're going to carry these two bills over to tonight's session. Because I want to get this thing resolved now. You're going to love me for that, both of you, but here's what I'd like to do, Libby. It's extremely difficult for the folk, to the committee members, to be able to read 2656 the way it's set out. Because I can't understand exactly what we're deleting and what we're adding. What I would like you to do is, if you could, by tonight, just look at this bill. I want the first sentence of that amendment put into the appropriate spot, and I want the deletion from 6 to 4 weeks, and I'm still unsure what we're doing with 3 if we just give you the first sentence. Now, I guess what I would like to do as a starting point is showing you intent what the committee, and if I could, and I'll let the committee members express to them, to you, if they disagree. What we're trying to get at is that, one, that the individual who voluntarily quits his job without good cause, that before he will be able to draw unemployment benefits, that he will have to work 4 weeks at covered employment. And we're going to take away, in essence, the 8-week waiting period for him. That's the heart of it. The second thing is I want to take care of the situation, as Representative Rogers said, about the Arias case, so that you can have the authority to consider certain limited exceptions to the Arias case. Now,
you said covered employment. Do you mean covered employment?
You know, I thought about that after I said it, and I'm. Is that standard with the other? Is it just any employment?
We don't consider, as long as a person earns equal to or in excess of his weekly benefit amount, we don't care whether it's covered or not. Some states do say covered, some don't. And we never have because it's an administrative...
You've never covered, you said, okay, don't put it covered employment in. And I got one other thing I want to talk to you about. If you could get an amendment that would relate, you know, one of the things that I think I found out about the employment division that bothers me somewhat is on this matter of drawing unemployment, that there's no reporting. It's an extremely difficult administrative problem for you people to determine whether a person is actively seeking, you know, and is in the job market. Now, I do not want to get into the idea that they have to come in person to draw their unemployment benefit.
They do.
They do.
They
okay.
come in every other week, and they
no. But they don't have to show you anything
yes,
that they've
they
done.
Do.
What do they have to show?
They have to show contacts they've made for each week they report for.
They actually have.
They have to show the name of the employer, the person contacted, the date, and the results of the interview.
But, Mr. Chairman, you do not follow up then and contact to see if they actually made those
no.
contacts. That's
if you have great doubts.
We have 120,000
right.
contacts every week.
I'm not going to get into that
okay.
because the employment agency will then be the largest agency in the state.
But if there's, you know, if there's no suitable work for them to go look for, they don't have to bring in an A-list.
Yes, they do.
To show that they are active.
Well, it depends upon the if it's the logging season and he's a logger and he's going to be off for 3 or 4 weeks, he just shows that he's contacting his former employer. Yes, but
okay. But if I'm a nuclear physicist in Bend, that was an example of what you
I would
hear
suggest
about.
That you start
reason,
looking for another
yeah.
type of work if Please. You're going to continue to live in Bend.
Okay, but that's what I mean. If I'm on unemployment, I don't have to go around and bring you a list of all the people that I applied for a job as a nuclear physicist.
No, but for some other job, he would. He'd have to pick out what else he felt he could do.
That would be suitable. Yeah.
What about a person that hires out to a hiring hall?
No, just as long as they show that they're on the out-of-work list and in good standing with the union.
Okay, Libby, the only thing I have is that on page 3, this section 5 is being deleted. That seems to me be much broader than what we're trying to reach. Am I right or wrong by just deleting that whole thing? Because that appears to me to be including things other than voluntary quits.
Well, yeah, it would mean that if you're discharged for misconduct, you have to work 4 weeks. If you fail to apply
okay.
for...
I want it limited only to voluntary quits. Okay? No, you can argue that. I mean, that's...
You want what limited to voluntary quits?
The 4 week disqualification, I mean, the 8 week disqualification period, waiting period taken out.
You want to leave an 8 week waiting period in for somebody that gets
yes.
canned?
Yes.
You mean laid off?
No, no.
No,
if you read the bill, see what it is 2 and 3, they that section 5 deletes an 8 week waiting period for discharge for misconduct, suspension.
Any of the things in sub 2 and 3.
That's right. That's exactly it.
There's basically three conditions under which disqualifications occur. Either you quit, you're discharged, or you refuse an offer of work or refuse to apply for a job. Now, if I understand the chairman, he's saying that remove the 8 week option for the voluntary quit and leave it available for all other individuals who may suffer disqualification.
Okay. That's where I'm going to start from.
It's just the way it is now.
And what do we do with sub 3?
No voluntary quits.
Sub 3, that's what, I don't know. See, that's the part, Libby, with that first sentence, I don't know what you're going to do with it. And this is what Gary asked me earlier. Looking at it, he doesn't know what you're leaving in or what you're taking out. And I can't answer that question. Now, what I want to know is if you're going to have that authority in Section 1, whether, in fact, you have to take A, B, and C out to be able to come within the definition of good cause. I don't know.
Well, if you take that first sentence in.
When you bring these in, would you bring the related fiscal impact with them?
Tonight?
All 17 of them.
Well, that's going to have a great deal to do with how I live on this thing. Yeah.
Maybe a little difficult to...
It's going to start at 7.
I won't be here until 7:30, so...
No ball game tonight. That's not easy.
I got one other question. I know you're trying to get to a meeting, but the bill on page 2, on line... 30. How do you administer that or companion clause? Who is a companion?
I knew
is that a common law spouse?
Not
or
necessarily.
Is that just a short term
I think we got into it. We got into it when with this, I think in the 73 or the 75 session, it had to do with this affirmative action thing and all the things that had to do with the homosexuals and the whole bit, that you could be living with somebody and you're tied together one way or another, so that you are, and so we changed the word from spouse to a companion in order to get away from that conflict.
Yeah, but you're not answering my question. If two people are living together as homosexuals, and they have for 2 weeks, and one of them gets transferred, and the other one wants to go with them, are you going to pay the one?
Not likely if we know what's going on.
Why would we disqualify them?
You would.
That's what it says.
But then they can requalify if they work for a week.
That's what I'm getting at.
Right. Yeah,
that's right.
I think the proper phrase today is probably not companion. The word is friend.
So you mean that would be the case? A homosexual relationship?
There are a lot of couples living together today that are not married for whatever reason.
I know that. And that's, forget about the homosexuals. All right. Forget about them altogether. Yeah. Forget about the common law.
Yeah.
You know, folks. Now let's take everybody in between that are just companions or friends, whatever you want to use. You disqualify them, and then they work a week.
Yeah, and they're back on.
They're back on.
Not necessarily. There are times when some of these people are also found to have quit without good cause, which gives them a 4-week disqualification. This part of the bill, one doesn't do away with the other.
Well, but good cause, but I mean,
put it all in perspective.
Okay, if they left without good cause, that's another thing. But if they left to go with their companion, that says 1 week.
Yeah, but all right, if they left without good cause to go with their companion, then they've got a 4 week disqualification.
Okay.
They run concurrently, the 1 week and the 4 week.
In other words, you might determine that it's just because somebody's been living with somebody for a couple of weeks.
I would not make a moral judgment on it, no.
Oh, I'm not talking about a moral judgment. You must have some cases like this.
Well, one thing, Representative Wilhelms, this law was also written to take care of the problem of the relatives, such as the aunt taking care, or one sister taking care of another, something like that.
That's a companion.
That's a companion, right. Quite frankly, it hasn't been too controversial. We either don't know about it or it hasn't cost us a great deal of trouble.
Boy, it could become controversial.
Yes, I believe you're right.
I wonder how Dan Rather would approach that on 60 Minutes.
Cautiously. Let me, now that I think about it, I want two amendments on that. Page 3, Section 5. I want the one the way that I said, that just on the voluntary quits, and then I want the amendment proposed the way it is right now to disqualify completely under just 2, not 2 and 3, but just 2.
Got that straight?
You know?
Just
2. In other words, for the discharge, suspension or something like that, there would be a complete disqualification. I don't want to do it to 3, though.
You're still going to leave 8 weeks in there for everybody other than voluntary.
No. That's what I'm saying. As I said, after I thought about it and what your concern was, I'm willing to look at it to 2, you know, discharges. In other words, 2 A, B, C, D, or E. But I do not want to put the automatic disqualification in for sub 3, which is this thing about being married or moving or something like that.
I mean, after 8 weeks, they'd still be able to qualify.
Yeah, they would be. Isn't that correct?
8 week thing for those who leave with...
Yeah, that's the thing.
You're talking about the leaving it like it is now for a domestic leave.
Yes, that situation.
In other words, an 8 week disqualification.
That's right. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. We're in recess.